Jane Poynter, and this is True Green. In December 2006, Dr. Mark Trexler authored a controversial paper called A Consumer's Guide to Retail Carbon Offset Providers. He studied and ranked the numerous firms selling carbon offsets, also known as carbon credits, and named several firms with credible products. However, some of the most popular companies in the fledgling industry came out smelling, well, rather bad. The report caused quite a flap. Dr. Trexler is Managing Director of EcoSecurities Global Consulting Services, an international carbon trading and consulting firm. I caught up with him at the noisy Energy and Environment Conference held at the end of every January in the foothills of Tucson, Arizona, where scientists, policymakers, and business leaders from around the world gathered to tackle the fabulously difficult issues of climate change and energy. Here's our conversation.
What is the take-home message about the carbon credit market?
You're talking about the voluntary market as opposed to the Kyoto Protocol market. The rules are still in the process of being developed. There's a lot of junk out there that people are trying to move into the market. And so it really is a bit of a buyer beware situation in terms of trying to make sure that you're buying something that has some value.
How does the buyer beware, really? I mean, unless you're incredibly knowledgeable about the subject, how on
right.
earth does anybody make sense of it?
And that's a real challenge, and that's why in the report that we came out with for Clean Air, Cool Planet, we basically said, if you go to these eight particular retail offset sellers out of the 30 or so that were on the market at that time, you can be reasonably confident that you're getting something that's worth buying. Because it really is unrealistic to ask individual consumers to try and sort all of this out. Although, the more that individuals just ask some basic questions and show that they're interested, even that will help the market move along. What we really need is something else. We're actually working for a client right now on a totally different approach, which is to come up with a scoring system. So instead of a standard which sort of suggests that anything that barely passes the standard is great and anything that barely doesn't pass the standard is terrible, even though they really could be virtually identical projects. A scoring system where, you know, you can be extremely confident that if you pick a project that scored 800 out of 1,000, you have a very good project. And if you pick a project that has a 300 out of 1,000, you can raise a lot of questions about what you're buying. But that kind of a scoring system helps the market pull itself up by its bootstraps because it incentivizes people to do higher and higher quality, which the standards, with just a single on-off threshold, they don't really do that.
What kind of benchmarks are there in this scorecard?
Well, the key one is the additionality.
Can you describe for people what the additionality is? It's a tricky concept for people to get, because when they think additionality, I think the person that's sort of the entry-level person into this discussion is thinking, well, it's taking CO2 out of the air, isn't it? Isn't that additional? So what does additionality really mean?
Well, additionality means that the existence of the carbon market has in and of itself led to the reductions that we're talking about. Because there are many things that are taking CO2 out of the air all the time. All the nuclear energy plants, all the trees being planted by the commercial forestry industry, all the energy efficiency that just happens year to year like clockwork. There are lots of things that in some sense take CO2 out of the air, but they're part of the normal dynamic of the economy. If you start trying to reward people for all of those things, you're not actually making anything different happen. To make something different happen, you have to find activities and incentivize them with the carbon offset money, with the carbon market. Make things happen that wouldn't have otherwise happened. That is what is additional.
And so when you go to look at groups like the Chicago Climate Exchange, what do you think about how they score a project?
Well, the Chicago Climate Exchange will agree that additionality is key, but you do find disagreements as to how to measure additionality. The way the Chicago Climate Exchange approaches additionality, it's more, well, it happened and it reduced emissions, so it's okay to reward it. And my argument would be that that's not really what additionality is. Additionality is something that really would not have happened but for the existence of the carbon market.
So you're talking about financial additionality?
No, no. There are many ways that the carbon market can make things happen other than purely financial means.
Like how?
Overcoming information barriers, bringing attention to the fact that we need to be doing some of these projects, and capital suddenly becomes available for projects. I mean, those projects were always there. It's just that nobody really had paid attention to them before until we started talking about the need to do climate change mitigation. Suddenly, capital becomes available to those projects. They may even be profitable projects, but they weren't being done. So the carbon market is still making those reductions happen. So it doesn't have to be that only money-losing projects can be additional. That simply isn't the truth, and that's sort of a red herring that you hear brought up all the time.
When you go through all the paperwork to file for certificate for a project under the Kyoto Protocol, you have these various tools you have to use. One of them is the additionality tool.
Right.
That in and of itself isn't overly burdensome. However, there is a huge amount of red tape involved in doing the types of monitoring and verification of projects under the Kyoto Protocol, which is one of the negatives that people point to of doing business that way. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the Chicago Climate Exchange is trying to cut a lot of that red tape.
Right.
Then you get into the problems of, are you really doing enough monitoring? Where's the happy medium? How do we address this huge challenge?
One of the things is that the issue of additionality, which is really the key issue, there's no way to monitor and verify whether something was additional. The whole idea is you're doing something that wouldn't have otherwise happened. Once you've done something, it's very hard to prove that it wouldn't have happened otherwise. I mean, it's sort of a binary thing. So you can monitor and verify the reductions, but you can't, through monitoring and verify, prove that something was ever additional. That's basically a determination that has to come up front. And I think there's some sense that if we impose all these other transaction costs and make the whole process as burdensome as possible, that somehow increases the likelihood that only quality reductions come out the other end. And unfortunately, that's not true. In fact, the more uncertain you make the process, the more difficult you make the process, to some extent, you're really incentivizing people to find non-additional projects to try and bring through the process, because those are the lowest risk projects to them. You know, if they don't get through, or if something happens, or if something unforeseen happens, they didn't really cost them anything anyway. So what do they care? But to go out and do real projects and spend real money and then face a lot of uncertainty as to whether that project will be approved, that's a big problem.
We really need to have billions of dollars or euros or whatever pouring into projects that are really making a difference to the atmosphere that otherwise wouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of money pouring into the carbon market, but the kinds of projects that we're seeing being done are all mostly, you know, relatively small, really. I mean, they're, you know, only millions of tons at most. How do we get more money pouring into viable, large, huge-scale projects that are going to make the difference?
I mean, there are some large projects. The HFC projects in China are, you know, tens of millions of tons for a single project. But you're right, the vast majority are smaller. The real thing that I think you're talking about is that people have to have confidence that the carbon market's going to be around for a while and that carbon's going to be worth a significant amount of money into the future. Right now, that's very hard for people to have, that confidence, because we don't even know what's happening after 2012. As of right now, none of these projects have any value after 2012. If you're trying to swing a decision as to whether to build, you know, a pulverized coal plant in China versus a gasifier in China, you don't make decisions like that on the basis of a couple of years of $10 a ton CO2. But if people knew that CO2 was going to be worth $40 a ton, $50 a ton, and they knew that it was going to be worth that for 10 or 15 or 20 years, then you would start seeing real investment in large projects. You'd start seeing a real difference because you'd be sending a market signal. You know, without the U.S. in the market, there's just so little demand. in the market, that it's very difficult to get the price up to where it needs to be. One of the key things about these markets is that they do need to be incentivizing new technology development, for example. That's what these markets should be doing. But at $10, $15, $20 a ton, they're just not going to do that. Once the markets get to $30, $40 a ton, they will. And that's a function of more demand, getting the U.S. into the market. It's a function of having a good additionality policy so that you get a lot of the junk out of the market. And that's when you'll start to see sort of the kinds of carbon prices that will start leading to the change in the overall system. Right now, we're just nibbling around the edges of all of this stuff.
So going back to the voluntary market, has that changed much?
Well, we really haven't gone back and updated any of that since 2006. I mean, that was a very unusual project for us as a consulting firm. You normally don't go out and do projects that are going to piss off 75% of the people who you're talking about in a report. I mean, we had to travel with bodyguards after coming out. I'm exaggerating just a bit. But people were seriously angry after that report. The organizations that were seriously angry had some powerful friends in foundations and elsewhere, and we paid the price for doing that report.
How do you mean?
We lost those relationships, because by coming out with that report, people got angry with us and stopped talking to us.
So you've lost the funding?
Well, we were in sort of discussions with them. We didn't lose funding per se. We hadn't had funding. But we were in some very interesting business discussions that sort of came to an abrupt halt after that report.
Right there, you've really hit on a very tricky subject. You know, how to get really good, unbiased research in areas...
Right.
That might affect your funding.
Do you know factcheck.org? It's a site that basically reviews political ads, and they're set up by the Annenberg Public Policy School is funds them, and they're an equal opportunity critic. They will tear any political ad to shreds if it's not accurate, and they'll go in and they'll really look at, is this true? We need the same thing for the climate field. Everybody's spinning. Doesn't matter who you are, they're spinning. And for the press and for individuals, it can be very hard to figure out what's working, what's not working, what's a good idea, what's not a good idea, because it's very hard to get sort of unbiased and non-influenced information. And we desperately need that kind of an organization in the climate change field.
I'm assuming you're saying it's not just, is climate change happening or is not? I think we're kind of beyond that discussion. Now you're saying, aside from the science of climate change itself, there's the science of all of these solutions and their deployment.
Exactly.
And is what we're talking about doing
scientifically
accurate? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and not even just scientifically accurate, but you know, if there are 10,000 ideas out there, which there are, which of them should we be pursuing in the near term? I mean, which are the ones that have the biggest payoff in the near term? And that is not easy to figure out when everybody is out making, you know, claims for whatever they happen to be doing, because they have to make outrageous claims, because that's where what their funding depends on. So you have a little bit of a vicious circle.
From a layperson's point of view, it's a lot around, oh my goodness, this is so overwhelming, there's so much to do. What does make sense?
Right.
I mean, there's such a fog in the air.
Right. Pew Center, you know, is very successful as a purveyor of information. I mean, there are a whole bunch of organizations that present information to the press and to the public. But the problem is that, you know, one way or another, all of those organizations are associated with industry groups now. All of the environmental groups are associated with industry groups and have industry advisors and all that kind of thing. So it's just not easy to figure out who doesn't have an agenda.
And so now?
We ended up being acquired, and so now we're sort of back in the commercial side of the game. Still trying to promote good policy solutions, etc., but recognizing that that as part of one of the major market players, I mean, by definition, we're suspect too now, just because we're part of an organization that has very clear perspectives on the market and a very significant financial interest in the market. So as the consulting group within that organization, we still try and do the best work we can, but you won't find us putting out any more reports like the Clean Air, Cool Planet report. Now we will start soon seeing consumer reports coming out with that kind of information, which is who should have been coming out with that kind of information to begin with. It's just that back then in 2006, nobody had ever looked at the questions.
Well, the Federal Trade Commission announced that they're going to start looking into the claims of, you know, green labeling.
Well, they had a major hearing 2 weeks ago. What's a little bit interesting about that is that the only thing they can do is evaluate whether there's deception going on. They're not necessarily interested in coming up with a standard for the carbon market. That's not their job. All they're trying to figure out is whether there is deception in the market that their enabling statute allows them to address.
What do you think they're going to find?
Well, you know, I think that they should find that there's deception in the market. Not the entire market, obviously, but there's a lot of questionable stuff being done in the market. But I have no sense of how that'll ultimately play out in politically.
Is there a bright spot in all this?
Well, I think the bright spot is just that 12 months ago, nobody cared about any of these things. I mean, one of the reasons that the voluntary market is sort of in the trouble that it is because it didn't matter until very recently. Until 9 months ago, 12 months ago, nobody had ever been called on the carpet for an inappropriate claim. And so it was very hard to even convince companies that they needed to be careful about what they said, because nobody had ever gotten in trouble for it yet. In the last 9 months, people have been getting in trouble a lot for saying things that really aren't true. I mean, Business Week has come out several times. The Financial Times has gone after certain kinds of carbon offsets with a vengeance. The Los Angeles Times came out with an exposé. There's been a lot of negative press. And so now we'll start to see the market try and fix itself, because now there's a reason for people to care.
And should people be buying offsets?
Well, I think absolutely people should be buying offsets, although, you know, it's not as if the offsets themselves are going to solve the climate problem. The volume of voluntary offsets that we're going to sell into the market is pretty modest. What's really exciting about the offset market is that it's an opportunity to talk to consumers, to educate consumers, to get them to understand why we need public policy. We need to be having a much broader conversation with consumers than simply, hey, put your credit card into this slot and you'll come out climate neutral.
How do you see that playing out? What do you mean by that?
In this whole market at this point, we're still just talking to the early adopters. We're just talking to the 3% of people who will do anything if you say it's green. Until we can figure out how to talk to the other 97%, we're missing out on where we need to go. We need to find ways of engaging a much larger community out there, because then the chances of getting good public policy in the future go up if the public actually understands this issue better. Consumers don't understand carbon offsets at all. And so how do you sell a consumer a climate neutral product if you can't explain to them what climate neutrality even means in terms of offsets and how offsets work? And we really need to get, you know, the marketing and advertising industries involved in figuring out, how do we sell these concepts? How do we talk to consumers about these things? And to date, they are basically not involved at all. You know, no major corporations have really brought significant advertising and marketing talent to bear to sell climate change products and services. The early adopters are not the solution to this problem. It's the much larger population, because they're the people that elect representatives and senators and presidents. And at the end of the day, this is a policy play. This isn't a voluntary play. This isn't a marketing play. It's a policy play. Without serious national and international policy, we have no chance of solving this problem.
So you're saying that people need to vote for the environment?
They do, and they don't, is the problem. I mean, they do need to, but there's no data to suggest that they do. And it really is a bit of a catch-22 here, too, because if we want to tackle climate change, we have to entirely revolutionize our energy economy. And if we do that, there will be winners and losers. There's no question about it. So to say that we can do all of this and it's simple and it doesn't have to hurt anybody, unfortunately, is not true. The problem is that if we don't do it, we're going to have a heck of a problem on our hands, or at least our kids will have a heck of a problem on their hands. And yet, we all know that you can't really go to the public and say, you have to sacrifice, because nobody wants to hear that from their politicians, and no politician goes and tells them that. I mean, put it this way, there is no problem that is less suited to four-year political terms than climate change, because they feel like they're going to bear the cost, but they don't see any of the benefits. What's in it for them?
Are you hopeful?
See, my academic training involves is an implementation theory, which is sort of trying to find all the ways that things can go wrong. And the purpose of that field is to try and fix those things before they happen.
So it's a mitigation, essentially.
It's a perfectly legitimate field, but it's sort of a depressing field, and nobody likes you in that field, because nobody wants to know that what they're pushing has fatal flaws, number one, because it doesn't help them get it through. And once they've passed it, they don't want you to actually study it, because you'll find that it had the fatal flaws that you could have predicted and fixed early on. So from that standpoint, from sort of an academic standpoint, it is hard to really believe that we can solve this problem. But I happen to think it's a key problem, and I've been working on it for 18 years. Call me stupid.
Thank you so much for taking the time with me.
Sure thing.
This has been an episode of True Green with Jane Poynter. For information on this and other episodes, go to www.janepoynter.com.